This is Zach Koopman from Carnegie Science Center. I'm here with Dr. Misha Angrist, who is assistant professor of the practice at Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. He has a new book out, Here is a Human Being at the Dawn of Personal Genomics, and he'll be speaking at our series, adult science series, Cafe Sci, which is on June 6th, 2011, from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the Science Center in Pittsburgh. Dr. Angrist, it's great to have you. Thanks again for agreeing to do this.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I'll just go ahead and let you kind of frame the issue of personal genome sequencing and, you know, kind of the effects it can have on medicine. So is there any way you'd like to frame what you'd like to talk about right off the bat?
The book is, the subtitle is At the Dawn of Personal Genomics, and so when writing the book, I really tried to keep that personal aspect in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was a graduate student in the 1990s, part of the time I was actually at the University of Pittsburgh, you know, we never looked at our own DNA. It was something that people just didn't do. It was not talked about, let alone encouraged. And so unless there was something wrong with you, or you were a participant in a research study, that just wasn't something that scientists or anyone did. And in about 2007, that really started to change. And so I was very curious about what that change would look like. What would it mean? Would people even care? Would the information be useful? Were people making money at this? Why or why not? All of those sorts of questions. And since I had spent most of my adult life in the lab, or thinking about genetics and genomics and human heredity, I was really compelled by the subject.
Okay. Your book is, you mentioned a personal touch, and I understand you've actually had this procedure done. You've had your genome mapped. That's correct, first of all?
Correct.
And I'm wondering, practically, how does the process work? What, for a user, does it look like, or patient, does it look like to have your genome sequence? What's the process like? Maybe if you want to go over that a little bit.
There are a couple ways to answer that question. Mm-hmm. It's possible anyone can get a genome scan. Mm-hmm. So for a few $100 or $99 and a few bucks a month, you can go to a company like 23andMe, and you spit in a tube and send them the tube and give them your credit card number, and in a few weeks they send you an email and say your results are ready. And what those results are about 500,000 to a million markers, that is, places in the human genome, sites in the human genome, of which there are 3 billion, where there is known variation. That is, most of us are, I should say, all of us are genetically identical to one another at 99 point something percent of the sites in our genome. But those, that other tiny fraction, that 1% or so, we vary from one another. And so that's what companies like 23andMe and Navigenics and DecodeMe are selling, is an analysis of that common variation. And so you would log on and you would be shown your ostensible risk for common diseases like Alzheimer's disease or diabetes, the genetic basis of how you respond to common drugs, or common prescription drugs anyway, maybe something about your genetic ancestry, where your ancestors likely went when they left Africa 100,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the analogy I use is, to get a scan from one of those companies is like getting a picture of the mile markers on a road.
Yeah.
Getting your entire genome done is like getting every single white line.
Yeah.
So that's what I had done initially in 2009, mm-hmm. and again late last year and early this year. And what that meant was giving blood, because blood gives you more DNA than saliva,
mm-hmm.
Or it's easier to get the quantity you need from blood than it is from spit. And then that the DNA gets extracted from that blood, and then it gets loaded onto a $700,000 or $1 million sequencing machine that then reads through those 3 billion locations multiple times. So in my case, 26 times over. And the reason it's so redundant is to make sure that it's accurate. So the second time my genome was sequenced, it was probably done, I don't know, 40 or 50 times over. And so that's when things get really head-scratching and difficult, is so now you have gigabytes or terabytes of data, and you have to sift through them, and you have to decide, what do I do with this? What am I looking for? And there's a growing number of software programs to help people do that, but we're still in very early days, and as I describe in my book, it was really tough sledding to sit there in front of an Excel spreadsheet with dozens or hundreds or thousands of genes and decide, you know, do I want to look at the broken genes that I have? Do I want to look at the genes that I just think are cool? Do I want to look at my ancestry? Do I want to look at rare variants or common variants? So I spent a few weeks doing that. And it was interesting, and I'm glad that I did it, but I can't really say that it's my idea of a good time.
Yeah. I suppose this would be a good chance to ask, you know, what is the benefit, just doing some, you know, quick and dirty research. The benefit seems to be something called personalized medicine, where maybe you have drugs catered to your own genetics or you have early detections of genetic disease or susceptibility to certain diseases that we know or think
right.
we know that. Were you able to glean much of that information yourself, or would you have to sit down with another consultant if you were a layman or something like that? Is that or is that something that's way far off where you are getting a dirty Excel spreadsheet and you know, there's a whole lot of it and you can look through that, but it's really hard to find what you want. Obviously that mile marker test is going to be a little bit nicer. Because
yes.
those are genetic
and
points of interest.
Much of the low-hanging fruit, that is to say, the stuff that might be useful to someone today, would be found in a scan like that. But the real truth is that if you're a healthy person, and your family history suggests that you're likely to die from the things that kill most of us, which is to say heart disease and cancer, your entire genome is sort of overkill at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that are useful right now, I would say, are drug response. So if you happen to develop, say, deep vein thrombosis, or you have heart disease, and then, you know, you wind up needing a stent, and you start to develop vascular problems, and you need to go on a blood thinner, response to those sorts of drugs, a large fraction of it is genetically determined, and so knowing which versions of those genes can be helpful in predicting what dose you need and how well you're likely to respond to those things. If you're of childbearing, or if you're male and interested in having children, you and your partner can now get screened for 100-plus relatively rare genetic diseases, and get some understanding of your risk for conceiving a child with with one of those diseases. So it is a pretty short list, and part of that is one of the great hopes of the Human Genome Project was that we would start digging into common diseases like type 2 diabetes and heart disease, and Crohn's disease and things of that nature, and that we would find common variants that were strongly predictive of who would get those diseases. And in fact, what we found are common variants, of which there are many, and each one seems to contribute just a small bit. And so the whole business of prediction becomes much, much dicier.
It seems to be the sort of way genetics kind of works. I'm not an expert, but I've studied somewhat since high school, and it just seems like always in studying you go with the simplest version, and then the teacher says, oh, but actually it kind of works this way, and there's always more complicating information. But
I think that's true. I think Gregor Mendel, the monk who studied peas, is still important and is still, you know, he still sort of walks in Darwin's shadow in most people's mind, because what he did was much less sexy, counting pea plants, versus, you know, painting this much broader picture of natural selection. And the thing is, and this is what I always tell my students, is, you know, Mendel was a brilliant experimentalist. He spent years making sure that his pea plants bred true. So there was never any confusion as to whether he was breeding a tall plant with a short one, or a round one with a wrinkled one, or whatever else. Those were very well-defined traits. Human beings don't breed true. We have this infinite phenotypic variation, the way we look, how tall we are, our body shapes, our cognitive capabilities. We have big genomes. We have 20,000 plus genes that are regulated in all sorts of subtle ways. So in one sense, it's not surprising that we turn out to be much more complicated than pea plants. And in fact, it might be weird if we weren't.
Yeah. I suppose we've covered some pros of personal genome sequencing, and I just wanted to address two kind of cons that I came across in some quick and dirty research. The first of which you kind of touched on, but not really, ethical concerns for genome sequencing, which I bet you get a lot with anything genetics, but I just maybe touch on one or two. I heard the term genetic discrimination, which I don't know if I'm a fan of yet. But
hope you're not a fan of it.
No, of the practice or the term. I don't really. Maybe cover what you think is relevant as far as ethical concerns.
Sure. Well, in the real world, we actually know of relatively few instances of genetic discrimination. Mm-hmm. That is, cases where, let's say, an employer looked at the DNA of its employees and said, I don't want to hire you because you're going to cost me too much money, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't think I would propose that would be the case if let's say genetic discrimination is so and is prevalent. I think it would be more out of a systematic medical practice type thing where certain people receive a test and others don't. And I don't know, maybe is that more relevant than say your employer taking a look or a big brother taking a look or something like that?
Well, the point I was going to make is, despite the fact that the scenario I described is not very common insofar as we know, this is what most people are afraid of with respect to genes. That is, will my employer or will my insurance company use my genetic information against me in some way? And so it was that fear, in large part, that led to the passage of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, otherwise known as GINA, that President Bush signed into law in 2008.
Okay.
And I think, as legislation, there are a lot of problems with it, which I won't go into, but as a psychological bit of reassurance to people that the government is going to do what it can to make sure that this doesn't happen, that people are not discriminated against in health insurance or employment based on their DNA or their family history, that's the message that GINA is trying to send. And since I don't even know if we have the final rules yet, you know, the way that it's going to be implemented. Mm-hmm. So it has not been tested in court.
Yeah.
So only time will tell as to whether it turns out to be a useful piece of legislation in practice.
Gotcha. Okay, and I guess my second sort of con is, again, from the quick and dirty research, just pulled some numbers. I think, I assume this is for the full scan, but in 2003, I put a full scan at about $3 billion. 2009, found that a U.S. National Institute of Health set a goal of 100,000, and by 2014, it's supposed to be 1,000. Cost of health care is always on our minds today, as employers or employees or as a nation. And that's a pretty drastic decrease. First of all, are my numbers somewhat in the ballpark? And if so, what do you foresee these sort of procedures doing to cost of health care? If you can even speak.
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, your numbers are pretty good. So $3 billion, I think 2.7 was the final tally for the Human Genome Project, which was one composite genome of several people. Craig Venter's was the first diploid genome, meaning it distinguished between the 3 billion he got from his mother and the 3 billion he got from his father. And I think his cost probably $70 million, something like that. Jim Watson of Watson and Crick Double Helix fame, his genome was on the order of $2 million. I can tell you that in 2009, mine cost $23,000. And I think in time it was done, it cost $4,000. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty safe to say that we will have a $3,000 genome this year and definitely a $1,000 genome, let's say, by 2014. Mm-hmm. It seems I would be surprised if that were not the case. So the cost of DNA sequencing has fallen by a factor of 10 basically every year for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that can't go on forever. So to the second point you're making, which is if everybody has their genome and sees what is potentially wrong with them, will they all run to their doctors and, you know, have their prostates removed or mastectomies or whatever it is? So this is a problem that was described by a very smart guy in Boston at Harvard named Zach Kohani, who talked about the incidentalome, meaning we're going to find all of these things and we're going to want to follow them up. And our doctors will want to follow them up for reasons of liability. And I think that is it's a legitimate concern. But I think it assumes that people will continue to hold on to this idea that their genes are a crystal ball, that their genes are destiny. Mm. When in fact, what all of the data say are not even close. That we're so complicated and our genes interact with our environment and gene expression, that is, the extent to which genes are turned on and off, changes, you know, every time we eat a bag of Cheetos. It's affected by diet, by the air we breathe, by climate, by infectious agents we come in contact with, by stress. So it's not simply, you know, we're not simply robots doing the bidding of our DNA. We are complicated and unpredictable. And so to have a genetic risk that is less than what we would call a Mendelian risk, that is a risk for a rare genetic disorder like cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy or something like that, but to simply have, you know, a 5% greater risk for type 2 diabetes or Crohn's disease or heart attack, and to know that that risk is only partially genetic and is really strongly affected by the environment, I think the fear that everybody is going to run to the hospital will dissipate quickly, if it hasn't already. So, you know, there have been at least 75,000 or 100,000 people who have gotten the genome scan, the mile marker analysis, and there's no evidence that they have been any sort of additional burden to the healthcare system.
Interesting. I guess I'll just close in you know, a lighthearted question. In how does it feel to have? You touched on this earlier, but how does it feel to have your own genome scan in full and have it? And you know, you saw that you had a few interesting facts, but do you sleep better at night or anything like that that you
have? You know, I tell people that my genome is the least of my worries.
I'm sure.
So in my book, I talk about, you know, some difficulties I've had over the last decade or so with depression and anxiety. And there was maybe a brief moment where I saw some of the versions of different genes that I carried and maybe got a little anxious, but I got over it pretty quickly, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I see it simply as something that I'm glad I have. Another analogy I use is that it's like having a savings bond. And so, you know, when you buy a savings bond, you overpay, and then it matures over time, and eventually it yields something. And the fact is, we don't know what the yield of a human genome is going to be for most people. There have started to be some cases, particularly of newborn babies with medical problems that have defied diagnosis, despite the best efforts of many experts, who have had their genome sequenced and useful information has come out of that, and it's had an impact on their treatment and their health. And so I would say that for those kids, you know, the savings bond has matured in short order and in dramatic fashion. I think for the rest of us, it's going to take a while.
Gotcha. Well, I want to thank you for being with me and answering my questions, and we look forward to June 6th.
Well, thanks for having me. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and I can't wait to be there again.